the wall was like in 2011. Absolute turmoil, death and violence all over the place. We supported villages like this through our own people, through cash, and through the fact that we are Ivorians. Ivorians run the business. We will do the same thing in Gabon. We'll have a Gabonese general manager there shortly, and this is our plan. We would do the same thing in South Africa. South Africa, here we are. CNR is the holder of an offshore license, block 11B-12B, which is located directly south of Mussel Bay. Our drilling target there would be maybe about 180 to 200 kilometers directly south of Mussel Bay in undrilled territory. This is just a look at the block. Again, you can't see it very well. I've got a fancy slide there in the corner to show you exactly where it is, but that is a large parcel of land. That's about 19,000 square kilometers of block. It has been drilled in the northern section for gas by Sucor a number of years ago. Ours is in virgin territory with high prospectivity. Now, what are we going to do? We feel that we have, as a company, we have made an obligation. We've signed a contract with South Africa under certain terms that we will drill this exploration well within our first expiration period. This we will do next year. However, the uncertainty of the future regulatory regime of petroleum in South Africa is of great concern to us. Our economic case and our legitimate expectations have been built around our contract, around the framework, the rights and the commitments contained in this contract. We've invested here in South Africa based on that. Changes to these terms could put us, or could result in us, thinking very long and hard about how we would further explore this block, how we would develop discoveries, and how we would go forward. Our written submission to this committee states our own company's position on matters related to the amendment bill. We fully support our colleagues who have spoken before us in the last couple of days. We are a signatory of the OPASA submission ourselves. And we want to see some progress made. Uncertainty is the word that we've been talking about a lot in the past couple of days, and uncertainty about whether or not it's state participation, free state carry, beneficiation, which is the applicable charter, export controls, all that uncertainty adds up to the potential for the industry to be stopped in its tracks before it even gets off the ground. It doesn't have to be this way. We want to sit down with government and engage in meaningful consultation to work these issues out. And there's a tremendous amount at stake here. Finally, all you South Africans know this. This is God's own country. This is a place that is a wonder, and we will never engage in any activities here that will, to our knowledge, will damage the environment or harm any of our people. We want to work in concert with this country and make a great success of it. And I think that's all I've got to say.
Thank you. You're saying you've started already?
We have not.
You have not started.
Our exploration right was signed last May.
An exploration right was signed.
That's right. Last May, so we have 3 years to drill our commitment well, which we will do.
Up and above being a signatory of, you said, OPASA, offshore PASA. Who are your partners, in essence, from the South African side?
We are, at this moment, 100% holders of this block. However, we have identified a partner to join with us, to share this risk, and to lend their technical expertise to a very challenging well and potentially a development. We can't disclose who that partner is yet. It's still with government for approval. I expect within a very short time we'll be able to announce our partner, and we'll do this as a joint development.
Do you wish to engage members? Honourable Lorimer.
Thanks, Madam Chair. So just to get this straight, has there been any consultation with the department on the proposed changes to the regulatory regime? Any consultation?
Consultation with the DMR?
No, just in general, on the terms under which you are operating and with the prospect that they might change, have you been consulted on those possible changes?
Please make use of your mic.
We haven't been consulted directly. We have consulted with the DMR indirectly on these matters, and we have written to Minister Shabangu about these.
You've talked to Minister Shabangu about it?
Yes.
Not the DMR?
Minister Shabangu, yes.
Members, can we pass? Honorable Kuno?
Thank you, Chairperson. What exactly do you want us to change? I mean, you are saying that should this law be passed in your presentation, it's going to make you go away from South Africa.
No, not necessarily.
You are going to take your investment elsewhere. What exactly do you want us to pass here? You know, your colleagues earlier on, the last presenters, the ones before them, they are saying government is over-regulating them. But things have not been right. I think you've been here for some time. You see things that are not right. And somebody has to regulate. And government has to do that. And they're saying we are over-regulating, which is exactly what you are saying. Maybe not in those terms, but that's what you are saying. But what exactly would you like us, in any section of this bill that you're talking about now, what is it that you want to see change or what you want to amend? Thanks, Chairperson.
Respond to that?
Okay. What our company would like, and I think what our colleagues would like, is that the contract that we have signed with the South Africa is honored, and that's it, really. We are here and investing on the basis of that contract. And if that changes our whole investment view, may change. It may not, but it may. That's what we like. We want what we signed up for.
That's it. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Do we have Center for Applied Legal Studies? Carls? No? Oh, okay. Do you mind coming to the site to... If you have the rest of your colleagues, can they come with you? Are you also one man alone? One man show? Okay. Just switch off the mic next to you. I just hope, honourable members, you understand that there's no flights booked today for anyone of us. It looks like we're here until 5. Okay, let's shoot.
Thank you, honourable chair, honourable members of the committee. I'm Louis Neyman, the attorney in the Environment Program at the Center for Applied Legal Studies at the University of Witwatersrand. We have made full comments, and I'll just be summarizing a couple of our main points. The NPRDA strives to promote economic and sectoral growth, the creation of employment and investment opportunities, as well as social upliftment of mine-affected communities. The Act accepts attempts this within a framework of principles of equity, participation, and sustainability. The Amendment Bill has a duty to drive this development prerogative while observing strict adherence to these principles. The Amendment Bill addresses many of the issues raised regarding the existing Act, and these developments are welcomed. It, however, also raises certain questions which must be addressed. Starting with the definitions, we're actually pleased to see that the bill before Parliament replaces the definition of historically disadvantaged with a clause embracing all citizens, categories of persons and communities disadvantaged by unfair discrimination before the Constitution. Moving on to the objects of the Act, there is a certain concern pertaining to redress and redistribution which we raised regarding the narrowing of the objects of the Act. The current MPRDA expressly singles out women as a category of persons for whom opportunities to enter the industry should be expanded and who should benefit from the exploitation of mineral resources. The Amendment Act of 2008 added a reference to communities in this context. We note with regret that the version contained in the draft bill deleted the reference to both women and communities, and we question this. Moving on to participation, an essential part of transformation for us is the facilitation of participation in decision-making by those who stand to be affected by such decisions. Typically, the communities living in close proximity to planned mining developments struggle to gain access to decision-making processes and must overcome a number of challenges to do so. It is thus vital that these communities are given an opportunity to be heard on every decision on exploitation of minerals that has a potential to affect their rights and legitimate expectations. We viewed, and we constantly view, one of the most acute clashes of interests of communities and extractive industries occurs where an application to mine involves land on which a community resides. The 2008 Act recognized the need to protect communities in such circumstances and consequently inserted 2A into Section 23, which empowered the Minister to impose conditions in order to protect the rights and interests of communities, including conditions requiring the participation of the community. The bill removes this reference to participation requirements, which is unfortunate given the country's commitment to transparent and accountable governance and a participatory form of democracy. Involved in that is the general consultation requirements. We note that the obligation to consult with interested and affected parties has been expanded by the substitution of Section 10. The proposed amendment is in particular places obligations on the applicant as well as the state, and this is welcomed, as any acknowledgement of the seminal importance of meaningful consultation is a progressive step. In the light of recent history and in the light of the importance given to social and labour plans, social and labour plans are a fundamental component of our mineral licensing system, which have been cast in the spotlight. There are a number of provisions of the bill impacting on the regulation of SLPs which merit attention. Section 2I has been amended to clarify that the objects include requiring the rights holders to contribute to labour sending areas in addition to the area in which the mine is actually situated. While this is not currently an express object of either the MPRDA or the regulations, this amendment is welcomed as it brings the legislation as a whole more in line with the regulations dealing with SLPs, which make express reference to infrastructure and poverty eradication projects. The bill also introduces a requirement of periodic review. Periodic review is an important addition to the legislation and can be viewed as a response to current failures in monitoring and enforcing of such SLPs. We've viewed in many of our fieldwork and research that SLPs are, there's certainly a gap in monitoring of social and labour plans currently. But for oversight to be effective, it will have to engage thoroughly with the soundness of both the design and the implementation of the SLP. A major omission in this is the absence of a requirement to consult with mine-affected communities in the review process of these social and labour plans. One cannot have an accurate picture of whether an SLP is responding to community needs and achieving its goals without obtaining the perspectives of the intended beneficiaries. The bill should require notice to communities of the review and the opportunity to make both written and oral comments on the existing SLP and the ways in which it should be approved. The amendments to Section 23 now empower the Minister to, after having taken into consideration the socioeconomic challenges, to direct the holder of the right to address those challenges or needs. Thus, in addition to the new monitoring power, the Minister can now issue directives to compel the meeting of socioeconomic needs, as well as the remedying of contraventions of environmental management obligations, allowing directives to improve SLPs if they do not adequately address the socioeconomic needs of the area. This is positive, although there is a shortcoming in that no guidance is provided to the circumstances and the manner in which such discretion can be and should be exercised. And from the conversations that have been had today, the meaning of this discretion and what this discretion actually entails is quite important, especially in the view of social and labour plans. The amendment of Section 102 deals with the amendment of rights, permits, programs and plans. A serious problem is not addressed by the bill is the absence of an opportunity for public participation in relation to the amendment process. One of the issues flagged in our previous comments was the continuing anomaly of, on the one hand, requiring participation in the various licensing processes, but while on the other hand, leaving this to the discretion of the Minister in the context of amendments to licenses. And although we realise that this could be cumbersome in terms of timing, it's very difficult to think that the amendment of a certain right isn't as important as the actual right when it was issued. Participation would also allow some assistance to government regulations in making better, more informed evaluations of licenses that benefit from the knowledge and perspective of all key stakeholders. There is a risk that the amendment process will be seen by applicants as a way to dilute the more onerous conditions without consulting the communities whom these conditions may actually protect. On to REMDEC. It's widely acknowledged that the function of the Regional Mining and Development Environmental Committee under the MPRDA has been somewhat problematic. It is therefore encouraging to see the evidence of the reconsideration of the structure, and we welcome the proposed amendment. We feel that the members appointed to REMDEC must possess the expertise in mineral and mining development, mining environmental and management, and petroleum exploration and production as is provided for. We however propose that expertise in sustainable development and community engagement be added to the list for the reason that the body's activities are only triggered in instances of objection to an application and hence typically of community dissatisfaction. The provision for the appointment of consultants in the new Clause 10C would make gathering of this kind of expertise on REMDEC possible, enhancing a mix of skills for the benefit of communities and the broader public. The inclusion of reporting requirements in Clause 10G would enhance good governance. It should be made explicit that these reports will be public documents in line with the constitutional commitment to transparent and accountable governance. Moving on to the establishment of Ministerial Advisory Council, the insertion of Section 56A-F replaces the Minerals and Mining Development Board with a Ministerial Advisory Council. We express concern about the absence of a requirement that representatives of non-governmental organizations or community-based organizations be included. We further raise a concern that it's not mandatory for experts or people with relevant experience to enhance the functioning of the board. More specifically, this absence limits the ability of the council to realize its purpose of enabling the minister to make informed decisions and sound policy, so as to advance the twin goals of sustainable development and growth and transformation of the extractives industry. Decisions on sustainability involve evaluating highly specialized and technical information. The input of experts is essential for informed decision making. And NGOs offer a vital input in conveying different perspectives to those offered by government, business, and organized labor, adding to a productive debate. It is vital that the perspective of communities impacted by mining activity be integrated into the highest levels of decision making regarding the sector. The amendment of Section 20 focuses on the regulation of bulk sampling. In our experience, this process is often taken advantage of, at times conducted under the guise of, mining is sometimes conducted under the guise of bulk sampling. This is not only unlawful but highly detrimental to environmental rights of communities, since the environmental controls on prospecting, of which bulk sampling is a form, do require that applicants put in place the same degree of environmental safeguards that are required for mining licenses. We therefore wish to see a greater clarity in the provisions that regulate bulk sampling. Clarity would enable the department to effectively regulate this process and to close the loopholes allowing some abuse in this preliminary testing phase. We welcome the changes to the bill that help tighten the regulations. It will make it easier for mine companies to comply with the law if they have access to clear parameters for determining what activity is permitted under a prospecting license. The issue of closure certificates is one that's been around for some time, and the amendment of Section 43 affects closure certificates. The draft bill decouples the return of the financial provision from the issuing of the closure certificate. The minister was given the discretion to retain any portion of the financial provision needed to address latent and residual safety, health, or environmental impact, which may become known in the future for another 20 years. We point out the inadequacy of the 20-year period when many environmental impacts or seriousness thereof only become apparent far later. This is vividly illustrated by the current problem of acid mine drainage, or AMD, which has only been acknowledged decades after it first developed. We note that the bill still retains this 20-year cap. Another issue flagged is that Section 43 of the MPRDA imposes an obligation on the holder of the right or permit to apply for closure certificate in the context of mine closure. However, the draft bill inserts subsection 13, which provides for the exemption of those holders of rights or permits who had caused no environmental damage. Although exemptions from regulatory provisions can have the positive effect of easing regulatory and administrative burden, having no clear yardstick for determining whether one falls within an exemption creates certain loopholes. In addition, there is not a single mining operation that I can think of that has resulted in no environmental damage. Rather, the section should be read as exempting those responsible for the environmental degradation to be below a certain threshold. Unfortunately, the bill provided no guidance for determining this particular threshold. Fortunately, the bill offers more clarity on when the exemption will apply. Under the revised exemption applies to holders who, prior to abandonment of the right, had not conducted any invasive operations yet. What invasive operations mean are not described. Lastly, a very contentious issue is the relative roles and responsibilities of the Department of Mineral Resources and Environmental Affairs. The present system under the MPRDA gives the DEA the responsibility for environmental authorizations for NEMA-listed activities, and the DMR the responsibility of managing the EIA process for mining and prospecting rights under the MPRDA. The inefficiencies and confusion created by this fragmented system are common cause. In essence, the solution proposed in the bill is the following. All environmental impacts are now regulated by NEMA, but overseen by DMR. We are of the opinion that the DMR should not be the competent authority for processing environmental authorizations and licenses and for overseeing compliance with the terms and conditions they contain, for three reasons. Firstly, there is a conflict of mandate between its role of promoting mining and that of ensuring compliance with NEMA. Secondly, the DMR presently lacks the specific skill set for environmental management functions. These skills set lie instead with DEA, which has built up a bank of skills and institutional knowledge that cannot be quickly replicated. Finally, The new arrangement will perpetuate the present situation of two systems of environmental regulation, one for the development in general and another for mining. It is crucial that the same level of scrutiny is applied to mining as to other high-impact forms of development, especially given the scale of environmental degradation that has been associated with mining in South Africa. Thank you.
Any issues, members? Honorable Kuno?
Thank you, Chairperson, and thanks to the presenter for what objective reasoning. That's what I'm just, I think people are tired. But Chairperson, what I wanted to say is that South African, we're still young, and with the 19 years of governance, consultants they are really not helpful. What they do really is sucking money from government, and most of them are not really doing what they're supposed to be doing. One of the presenters yesterday said that we need to employ necessary skills to make sure that this bill that we are busy with is implementable. And I think that to me it's key. Instead of having consultants who will come in for that particular time, make mistakes, and after that we have other consultants who will be rectifying their mistakes, let us rather have employ necessary skills into the department to make sure that some of the things that we're talking about here are implementable. Thanks, Chair. It's just a comment.
Honorable Schmidt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The Imperial Act made provision for a certain way in which environmental provisions were to be dealt with, sections 39 to, I think, 43. In the 2008 Amendment Act, it kind of brought in a three-phased process in terms of it would be, the environmental provisions would be dealt with under NEMA, but in the first stage under DMR, and the second, last stage then under the Department of Environmental Affairs. Now that seemingly has made way for a process which is only a two-phased approach. That seems to be the where Department of Mineral Resources will, in terms of the NEMA legislation, enforce environmental or unenforced, but will ensure that the environmental provisions are dealt with in terms of NEMA. But my concern basically relates to the following. The MPRDA Act was put into operation, sent to by the President somewhere early June, and a few days later it was, let's call it, re-proclaimed or re-proclamated, or the proclamation was withdrawn in terms of those certain sections. Where does it leave the environmental provisions in terms of the procedures to be followed? Because the MPRDA prescribed a certain process. 2008 Act was brought into operation. Then the provisions were kind of, let's say, withdrawn in inverted commas by virtue of a further proclamation a few days later. Where does it leave us in terms of the procedures and environmental laws?
Care to respond?
Just to the first comment regarding consultants, I think the right kind of consultant can bring the right kind of expertise. And when you talk about longevity of the consultant's contract, that is a problem, I do agree, when you have 14 different consultants on the same project. But there I'm just talking about a particular skill set that is required in a certain arena that government may not possess, that they can bring in consultants for that. But yes, I agree it is an issue. Regarding the amendments, I think everybody can understand that at the moment there's a bit of turmoil that's going on with the next 18 months and so on. And I think what everybody's looking for is just legislative clarity. I've been hearing it again and again and again the whole day. And this particular period has caused a lot of confusion. I think what we must remember is that what's lucky is, even though certain sections were repealed, we have Section 11 of the Interpretation Act, I think it is, that if there is no, if a certain law was repealed and nothing has been put in its place, but it will in the future, that particular law still remains. in Section 11 of the Interpretation Act. But to me at the moment, all we're asking for is that the environmental decisions be made by people that have the repository of knowledge regarding that. I think there will be, with the new phase, there will certainly be a teething process that will take place. But how much environmental degradation goes on during that teething process is a worry. And yeah, thanks.
Thank you very much for that. Noted. No comments. Do we perhaps have Conservation South Africa? Let's bite you quickly. Thanks. It's fine. Okay, would you please introduce your team and fire away. Thank you.
Good morning, afternoon. I realize we're heading into lunch period. My name is Sarah Frazee and I'm the CEO for Conservation South Africa. I'm here with my colleagues Farai Maziwe and Marguerite from WWF, and I'm representing joint submission from six organizations, also representing the environment and social linkages between people and community sustainable development. And specifically, I'm going to be talking about mine rehabilitation and closure and the retention of financial provisions, section 43 of the amendment bill. I have a picture up here of a Transhex mine up on the West Coast, which has been applying for a closure certificate since 2000. And this is one of the areas that I've been working with for some time, and one of the reasons why I've been asked to give this presentation. Additionally, I've heard that you have heard a lot of foreign accents, and a lot of people talking about their work in West Africa. I've also worked in West Africa on the other side with social and environmental considerations, and I've seen the impact of inadequate closure policy in terms of human health, smaller companies coming in, and eventually orphaned and abandoned mines being quite negative, having negative impacts. So your financial provisioning, your closure policies are an absolutely essential part of this amendment. So I'm just going to give a brief input on the mine closure context, and I'm only going to be speaking on three issues. I do realize it's lunchtime, and then just the final vision of what can be achieved if we get these right things in place. Specifically, I also want to acknowledge that these conservation NGOs often, particularly to sit up here and present in front of the Mining Portfolio Committee, we realize there's often a perspective that we're in conflict with mining and always anti-mining, and that's simply not the case, particularly in we recognize the role that mining plays in the economy, but we also believe that if it's managed, planned thoroughly, that they can operate responsibly and they can develop restoration systems that restore ecosystems. It has been proven. And they can make positive and lasting contributions and contribute to social successful closure if the policies and the partnerships are in place. So why is the MPRDA revision on closure important? Well, specifically, I think a lot of times people focus on the risk mitigation side of things. If we don't have enough money, is there going to be secondary degradation that's going to lead to a long-term cost to the state or long-term impacts like the acid mine drainage and also to communities? But also I really want to put in the mindset of the honorable members that there's also this is a development opportunity. If you can get closure process right and you get that sufficient provisions in place, you can manage those provisions in a way that supports the development opportunities. And that the way that currently closure is being done, that this investment in sort of a few small hairdressing salons and things, it's not actually what you're trying to achieve. So in 2009, the Auditor General looked at all of the abandoned and orphaned mines in the country. There were 6,000 at that time. And the estimated cost to the state of cleaning up those areas was $30 billion. That was in 2009. I guarantee you it's probably 30% more now because there's no application. I can tell you from the Namaqualand area that that's happening. So why create more? The current situation, as the previous speaker mentioned, the legal responsibility in Section 43.1, it used to be that the minister, that the responsibility only was held with the company until the minister issued a closure certificate. The proposal now, the proposed amendment says notwithstanding issue of the closure certificate. So the legal responsibility remains with the mining company, and we applaud this amendment. This is the polluter pays principle, and it's grounded in Section 24 of the Constitution, as well as with other legislation of the country, mitigating risk to the state and its constituencies. In Section 43.3, we just also want to recognize another issue that I've heard mentioned and raised, that there's this globally what happens when it comes to mine closures, that the big companies, instead of applying for a mining permit or a mine closure certificate, simply will seek to sell on, or they will maintain such a low level of investment, as has happened, that it actually nothing is happening. So we also want to encourage in the amendment that the legislation give the ministry the right to assess and deem closure and force a company to actually release the closure processes, which releases that financial provision and forces the development opportunity to happen. There are so many mines in this company that are simply ticking over with 14 people, when in fact the restoration efforts, and I can speak from, a West Coast experience, will generate 168 jobs for 10 years if that policy is triggered. So really, that would ensure the contribution to job creation, environmental protection, and long-term development objectives. Finally, we also are raising that the current situation of the MPRDA allowed the ministry to hold on to a portion of the financial provisions for any environmental impact, which became known in the future. And now this has been changed to this period of 20 years. Again, like the second speaker, we find the 20 years sort of an arbitrary number. We're not sure where it came from. And the impacts of mining operations completely differ from one mineral to another. 20 years may be too long, it also may be too short, and depends on the circumstances. So we're really advocating that the retention of financial provision should be made to address the actual environmental damage inflicted, and that this should be proportionate to the actual investment. And the retention period must be for the predicted life of the impacts, and that can be assessed at cessation of mine. It can be modeled, and there's an example in your handout towards the end of a sulfur plume. There's technology available, and that certainly over time, the DMR could develop a schedule of probabilities of longer-term impacts so that for a sand mine, you wouldn't want to necessarily hold on to the financial provisioning for 20 years, but for a coal mine or a gold mine, you would want to hold on for 80 years. So this is something that we really would strongly recommend looking at. And there's some examples in the health and the insurance sector that comes up with probability schedules in the law, and Marguerite can explain a little bit more of that. But I did also want to refer to the example of the acid mine drainage. Obviously, the South African government is going to be spending about 1.2 billion rand to clear up the acidic water, and most of these mines basically stopped operating more than 20 years ago. So what do you want to create a similar situation? I've had the honor of working at the Eden Project, which is one of the most famous sort of mine restoration success stories. It's now the fifth most visited tourism attraction in Europe, and they have a publication out that I strongly recommend you all look at and visit, which is called 101 Things to Do with a Big Hole in the Ground. And really, there is so much that can be done on areas where there has been a mining impact, and all it takes is a policy that forces people to think innovatively to contribute to the development of the country. Closure can be a tool for job creation and development. It can't be made easy to just walk away and leave the bill with the state. Again, along the West Coast, for example, I'm just leaving you with this. We had a major, Stratum van der Merwe took a mining dump from one of the De Beers mines and converted it into a land art installation, which nobody can see. So this is because they decided to sell on and transfer their mineral rights. And currently there's only 14 people being employed. And so there's a clear example of what can be done. So. Any other questions?
Honorable, just forgot his name now. Honorable.
And that's Noble Bizeba Nina.
Honorable Rosemary Sonto.
It's lunchtime, shame.
Oh, wow. Thank you, Chairperson. Madam, suppose you were DMR or you were government. What would you have done to the dodgy mining houses who would plunder and leave? Do bulk sampling and just leave it as it is and say, we found no minerals. What punitive measures would you take? Put yourself in our shoes. Thanks.
Honorable Ngele.
Thank you, Chair. I think I do understand your frustrations. Or I don't know what to call them. But some of the things are exactly what DMR is doing, like the cleaning of the acidic water. That is in process, they are doing it. And really, if they are doing it, it doesn't mean that they will just all of a sudden do everything at the same time. It will start with certain mines and then it goes on and it goes on. Rehabilitation. It is what is being done. I've seen mines that have been rehabilitated. Yeah, they are done, and those that haven't been done yet, I'm sure they're still on a process of doing that. Thank you.
Do you wish to respond?
Yes, please. To the question of what would I do if I was in DMR's shoes? I think you're right. DMR is trying to do the right thing in terms of restoration. In terms of the punitive measures for these dodgy companies, I really do think we have to look at our stock exchange. Okay. Look, I've been taking on some of the dodgiest companies. I have bodyguards, don't worry. I do think through the stock exchange, a lot of these companies make money simply by listing on prospecting, you know, that they've found a new vein of something. And there's no due diligence requested by the stock exchanges to actually prove that that vein is worth the value that it's being sold at. And so these guys are then allowed to often not only make money from the bulk mining, but also make money from the stock sale that then they say, oh, nothing was there. And they've also made money through different allowances. So I think tighter restrictions in the stock exchange as well. I don't know if DMR has control over that, probably not. But I would suggest that that needs to be tightened up here, and London apparently are the only stock exchanges that don't do due diligence. Australia and the New York Stock Exchange does before you're allowed to list. So there's some work in the financial side of things. I would hope that then the DMR could really assess the value of the resource before the license is granted, which would enable them to make a decision about whether it is just prospecting or if they are going to try to mine and run. And the financial provisioning and collecting some financial provision for even prospecting in that case where it might be a mine and run situation is something I would advocate. In terms of the rehabilitation and the length of time, I agree, but I just want to echo what the previous speaker said, is that sometimes DMR doesn't have the correct expertise. So I've also been involved in reviewing some environmental management protocols, and I've also been taken on mining trips where they show me their best restoration. But then you read their EMPR or their closure plan, and they say, oh, they describe in detail how they're going to restore it. But then they'll say, oh, and we're going to apply this on every other hectare. Not every hectare, every other hectare. One sentence in 700-page document, which basically halves the liability, and in fact makes, if you're an expert, you can say, if you apply it to every other hectare, it means it makes not a difference at all, because I just want to show you what happens is with, especially in some of these windy areas, the way the plumes go. If you restore a hectare and you have an unrestored hectare adjacent, that wind that blows off kills the restored hectare. So you've just thrown your money into the wind, literally. So it's one sentence that's embedded deep in an EMPR that gets lost, that halves the financial provisions and allows these things to happen. Sorry, Farai would also like to add. Yeah.
Actually, also just to sum it up, like you said, the DMR is doing rehabilitation and restoration, and we fully acknowledge that. But the short of it is that DMR should not have that responsibility in the first place, because it is the responsibility of the mining company that caused those impacts to restore and do rehabilitation. So this is something that it's a burden that's being passed on to the DMR, which is basically taxpayers' money that should not be used for that. So that's what we are trying to push for, and we're saying the 20 years in question and the thing about holding the financial provisions should be done on a case-by-case and reviewed annually, depending on the mining operation, the minerals under the soil, and how long the latent or projected latent and residual impacts are likely to surface and be seen.
Yeah. Thank you very much. Doesn't look like there's any other comments or questions or answers. Thanks for the contribution. Noted. No comments. Can I request that honorable members, we have a lunch break of 25 minutes. flat and be back in here so that we can be back on track in terms of our time. Thank you very much.